Let's go in our Bibles to the book of John, if you would, please. John chapter 18. We've come now to the crucifixion. When we think of the passion of the Christ, this is what we think of. He's gone to Gethsemane, the oil press, and he's been pressed. He's prayed. Three different times he's prayed. His disciples have failed as far as being able to pray with him, to join with him in prayer, watching so that they don't fall into temptation. His disciple Judas has betrayed him up to this point. Peter has now denied him three times, and that's where we left the story last week. Looking at this systemic failure, the high priest, the failure of the chief priests, the failure of his own disciples, treachery, fear of man, hero complex, and in all of this, Jesus keeps his course. We're in John chapter 18. We're going to begin down in verse 28, and we're going to read through verse 16 of chapter 19. Jesus is going to be before Pilate. This is the last segment that John gives us before the crucifixion. John 18, beginning in verse 28, says, "They led Jesus from the house of Caiaphas to the governor's headquarters. It was early morning. They themselves did not enter the governor's headquarters so that they would not be defiled, but could eat the Passover. So Pilate went outside to them and said, 'What accusation do you bring against this man?' They'd answered him, 'If this man were not doing evil, we would have not delivered him over to you.' Pilate said to them, 'Take him yourselves. Judge him by your own law.' The Jews said to him, 'It is not lawful for us to put anyone to death.' This was to fulfill the word that Jesus had spoken to show by what kind of death he was going to die. So Pilate entered his headquarters again and called Jesus and said to him, 'Are you the king of the Jews?' Jesus answered, 'Do you say this of your own accord, or did others say it to you about me?' Pilate answered, Am I a Jew? Your own nation and the chief priests had delivered you over to me. What have you done?' Jesus answered, 'My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have been fighting, that I might not be delivered over to the Jews. My kingdom is not from the world.' Then Pilate said to him, 'So, you are a king.' Jesus answered, 'You say that I am a king. For this purpose I was born, and for this purpose I have come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice.' Pilate said to him, 'What is truth?' After he had said this, he went back outside to the Jews and told them, 'I find no guilt in him. But you have a custom that I should release one man for you at the Passover. So, do you want me to release to you the king of the Jews?' They cried out again, 'Not this man, but Barabbas.' Now Barabbas was a robber. Then Pilate took Jesus and flogged him, and the soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head and arrayed him in a purple robe. They came up to him saying, 'Hail, King of the Jews,' and struck him with their hands. Pilate went out again and said to them, 'Behold, I'm bringing him out to you, that you may know that I find no guilt in him.' So Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe. And Pilate said to them, 'Behold the man.' When the chief priests and the officers saw him, they cried out, 'Crucify him! Crucify him!' Pilate said to them, 'Take him yourselves and crucify him, for I find no guilt in him.' The Jews answered him, 'We have a law, and according to that law he ought to die, because he's made himself the Son of God.' Now when Pilate heard this statement, he was even more afraid. He entered his headquarters again and said to Jesus, 'Where are you from?' But Jesus gave him no answer. So Pilate said to him, 'You will not speak to me? Do you not know that I have authority to release you
and authority to crucify you? Jesus answered him, you would have no authority over me at all, unless it had been given to you from above. Therefore, he who delivered me over to you has the greater sin. And from then on, Pilate sought to release him. But the Jews cried out, if you release this man, you are not Caesar's friend. Everyone who makes himself a king opposes Caesar. So when Pilate heard these words, he brought Jesus out and sat down on the judgment seat at a place called the Stone Pavement, in Aramaic, Gabbatha. Now it was the day of preparation of the Passover. It was about the sixth hour. And he said to the Jews, behold your king. They cried out, away with him! Away with him! Crucify him! And Pilate said to them, shall I crucify your king? And the chief priests answered, we have no king but Caesar. So he delivered him over to them to be crucified. Well, in his commencement address to the graduates of Hillsdale College in the spring of 2023, just this past spring, Robert Brown confronts them with a historical example of an eternal truth. I'm going to read a lengthy section here, but I want you to understand, this is a commencement address. This is at an American university. And he's going to set them up for living life successfully, not just as college graduates, but as people. Okay. He says, what I should like to do briefly in this commencement address is examine just one truth which is articulated over and again in the great Western intellectual tradition. It's typically accessed by means of a question, not the question of what we are to do, as important as that is, but rather what kind of person we ought to be. Do we hunger and thirst for righteousness, or do we seek our own advantage? In a way, there's no question in the moral and spiritual order more fundamental than that. A locus classicus for studying this question is found in Plato's Gorgias. In this dialogue, the character, Gorgias, is a sophist, which is to say an expert in teaching the art of persuasive speech. Paulus and Callicles are his students. Their concern is not being truthful or being just, but rather speaking in such a way that they appear truthful or just, and hence become convincing to others. Such sophists were, obviously enough, enormously useful to prospective lawyers, politicians in ancient Greece, and it should be equally obvious that their intellectual descendants are rather thick on the ground in our day. Socrates counts Gorgias and his students along these lines. He says, if a rhetorician teaches a politician to do what is unjust, he does that man and his city far more harm than good. To this, Paulus answers by means of a taunt. Wouldn't Socrates leap at the opportunity of having the power of life and death over others? No, Socrates says in response. For to put someone to death unjustly is in fact no power at all. And it is at this point that Socrates enunciates one of the most enduring teachings, a teaching that represents a watershed in the moral consciousness of the West. It is better, he says, to suffer wrongdoing than to do wrong oneself. And at this point, Callicles can no longer restrain himself. He gives clear voice to a position that endures to the present day. He says that what Socrates is calling justice is nothing but the constraints placed on the few strong by the many weak. It's a sort of guilt trip imposed by the powerless to limit the capacity of the powerful in order to get what they want. Socrates' argument for his position is simple. Surely suffering injustice is terrible. But what is worse is the corrosion of soul that takes place when one commits injustice. In other words, being unjust is far more damaging to the moral structure of a person's character than enduring the slings and arrows of injustice. So this is the question, young graduates. What kind of soul will you have? What kind of person will you be? Will you do whatever it takes to get what you want? Or will you accept even greater suffering in order to do what is right? Everything else in your life will flow from your answer to that question. And he develops it further in the speech. He says this is articulated a second way by asking, in the biblical form, this question is, whom or what do you worship? What will you be? Who will you be? That's determined by who or what you worship. Then he says a third way of asking our question is this. To which audience, finally, are you playing? As we come to this text this morning in John chapter 18 and 19, all three of these questions confront us today. What kind of a person will you be? Whom or what do you worship? And to which audience, finally, are you playing? What we find this morning is as we come to the cross, we see that there's no power in the entire universe that can compete with the beauty of submission. We're going to have a lot of different power plays going on. There's so much happening in this relatively brief narrative. But we've come now to the cross. We don't leave this part of the story now without crucify him being on the lips, both of the crowd, the priests, and of Pilate himself. So as we watch this, we're going to see a lot of different things happening. But before we do, I want us to look at 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 22 and 23. Because as we get ready and we look at the cross and we look at Jesus, we want to see what Jesus sees. It says, he committed no sin, neither was deceit found in his mouth. When he was reviled, he did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. We're coming to that moment in the life of Jesus where Jesus will receive judgment. Calvin points out that it's no small thing that Jesus receives a sentence against himself on our behalf. We who are judged and damned by Almighty God receives the judgment from man to be condemned, and also receives that verdict from the Father, condemned to stand guilty in our place as one cursed on our behalf. And as the greatest injustice in all of history plays itself out, Jesus looks at the one who is just and judges justly. How can we endure injustice? Only by banking on the fact that there is justice in this moral universe and that God will make all wrongs right. Praise God. So we watch this begin to play out. We see two different factions. We see the Jews, and we see an arrogant Roman. Not that the Jews are less arrogant. Both are defined by their pride in who they are. We see two different ways of doing life. We see the Jews focused on their religion, and we see Rome with all of its glory and its politics. We see the religious viewpoint of life where they're concerned primarily with righteousness, that is, that vertical aspect of life, being right with God. We see Rome in all of its political power and all of its statesmanship, focusing on justice, that is, that horizontal venue. And these two aspects of society are essential, right? Because you can't have this horizontal rightness without this vertical righteousness. And so these are the two arms of the law. These are the two tablets of the law. No other gods before me, and love your neighbor as yourself. Those are the two commandments on which the whole law hangs. And we see these two aspects suspended in the balance for us as we approach the cross. And in the center we find Jesus. Jesus, the one around whom this whole story, this whole plot, in fact, the whole of history revolves. We've looked at that already. But as Jesus interacts with the Jews, there's a focus now on ethics. What is it to be moral? What is it to be good? What is it to be righteous? And we're going to see that there's some paradoxes and some ironies that begin to play out between the righteous Christ and those who would present themselves as righteous within that moral universe. And then as Jesus works with Pilate and is confronted by Pilate, we see philosophical propositions coming out. As he inquires into the nature of truth itself, what is real? What is worth it? At the end of the day, Jesus, what are you living for or dying for? A man who has the world in his back pocket. He's at the head of the food chain as far as all of Palestine goes. And he's asking this question. What's it all about? Is it worth it? All of these things are coming into play as we approach this text. But as we watch this play out, we find that all of this, the philosophy, the religion, the politics, the ethics, the truth, the justice, the righteous, the morality, all of this hinges on one key aspect in this text, and that is authority. Authority. As you have Jesus, the Jews, and Pilate all interacting, what we're seeing is they're posturing, they're positioning themselves, and they're operating with a sense of authority. In what way does this text have to do with authority? Keep your fingers here in the book of John, and if you would, turn back to Matthew chapter 21. Matthew chapter 21. We're going to look at a text that we looked at with the youth not too long ago as we were working through our Bible study. But Matthew chapter 21, just before the crucifixion, as the Pharisees and the Sadducees, the lawyers, the scribes, are all confronting Jesus, we see in chapter 21, verse 23, that they come to Jesus as he's in the temple. He's overturned the tables. He's driven out the cattle and the money changers. And they have this question for him. Verse 23, he entered the temple and chief priests and the elders of the people came up to him as he was teaching and said, by what authority are you doing these things? And who gave you this authority? They ask him a question. Verse 24, then Jesus answered them, I also will ask you one question. And if you tell me the answer, I will tell you by what authority I do these things. So as the rabble-rouser Jesus comes in, overturns the cultural elite and upends the political status quo, the religious status quo, those who are charged with religion in that context come up to him and say, what gives you the right? What gives you the authority to do what you do? And they speak as those who are in authority. And they exercise that authority via questions. Jesus jumps on that and he says, I too will ask a question. I have the right to ask of you a question as you ask of me. And so he asks them their question. So in verse 27, so they answered Jesus, we don't know. Because they know that they're caught on the horns of a dilemma. And Jesus says, then I'm not going to ask you. And yet, he's not going to answer them. Then he goes and he starts asking them more questions. Verse 28, what do you think? A man had two sons. Verse 31, which of these two did the will of his father? So Jesus is asking them questions and he's forcing them to answer. Well, they said, the first, the one who didn't want to do it but decided to do it, rather the one who said he was going to do it but didn't end up doing it. So Jesus is asking them questions. Go down a little bit farther, down verse 40. Tells the story of a vineyard and one who lent out that vineyard to others, who drive out the tenants, who drive out all of the tax collectors and finally drive out the nobleman's son. And so verse 40, when the owner of this vineyard comes, what will he do to those tenants? Jesus asks. And he's engaging them in stories, but he's asking them, you fill in the blank. You tell me what principle is operating here. You tell me. And Jesus takes that authority from them as they begin to ask him questions, and he takes that questioning posture and says, "You tell me this. You tell me this. You tell me this." And so they're going back and forth with this questioning. We see down in verse 15 of chapter 22, the Pharisees went and plotted against him how to entangle him in his words. So they sent their disciples along with the Herodians, the Pharisees with the Herodians, and came to Jesus and asked him a question. "Teacher, we know that you are not swayed. Tell us then what you think. Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar?" They ask him another question. And then, verse 23, that same day, the Sadducees come, and they ask him a question. Verse 27, or verse 28, "In the resurrection, this wife who had seven husbands, whose wife will she be?" And Jesus answers their question. Down in verse 34, a lawyer comes to ask him a question. Verse 35, "Teacher, which is the greatest commandment in the law?" And Jesus answers the question. Now verse 41, while the Pharisees were gathered together, Jesus asked them a question. "Tell me, what do you think about Christ? Whose son is he?" They said, "The son of David." "Well, how is he David's son if in the Spirit David calls him Lord?" Verse 45, "If David calls him Lord, how is he his son?" And no one was able to answer him a word. So from that day, no one dared to ask him any more questions. 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 There's a question of authority in this text. It all revolves around authority. And what we have to be aware of is who's asking the questions. What questions are they asking? Let's look again at the structure of what's happening here. We've got religion and politics. We've got ethics and philosophy. We've got the Jews and Pilate. And we have Jesus. We're going to have four questions that are going to stand out this morning. The first deals with the ethical realm, where Pilate asks Jesus, or asks the Jews, "What accusation do you bring against him?" The next question comes from the political realm, where he asks Jesus, "What have you done? Are you the Jews? Why do these guys want to kill you? What have you done?" He's the politician. He's trying to keep the peace. We find a third question asked in the philosophical realm. What is truth? What is truth? And we find a fourth question asked in this religious realm, not from the Jews, but on the lips of Pilate. A man who operates by the fear of man, a man who operates by political savvy, political power. But when he starts to understand what's happening, when he starts to listen to the answers of Jesus, when he starts to evaluate all that's going on, he asks Jesus, "Where in the world are you from?" Jesus says, "That's just it. I'm not from this world. I came into this world, but I'm not from this world. My kingdom's not from this world." But all of these revolve around this one question. Are you the king of the Jews? Because if, in fact, Jesus is the king of the Jews, then he's the king of the universe. He's the Messiah. He's the hero of history. And as Pilate asks these questions, he doesn't even realize what questions he's asking. He's operating from a point of power. He's operating from the judgment seat. He's operating as the one in charge. And the Jews are coming to him in obeisance and seeking his permission and trying to manipulate and use this one who's in power. And ultimately they do. He gives them what they want. They manipulate the machinations of justice. They turn the wheels. They turn the cranks. They position everything just right so that they get the verdict that they want. And at the end of the day, Jesus is dead. But who's in charge as all of this begins to play out? So let's look at these four questions one by one, and we'll see how they play into the text. The question of ethics first. Pilate asks, "What accusation," verse 29, "what accusation do you bring against this man?" Let's look at the setting, verse 28. Immediately there's two competing realms. They, that is the Jews, They lead Jesus from Caiaphas' house to the governor's headquarters. So we're moving from religion to politics. This is essential that we're seeing these two different realms interacting with one another. So they led Jesus from the house of Caiaphas. He's the high priest. He's the head of religious activity there in Jerusalem. This is the capital city of Palestine. And they're going to the governor's headquarters. They're going to the political center of Palestine. And I want us to see very briefly as we begin this section, what role does Jesus play? We have the Jews and we have Pilate. We have the high priest, we have the governor. What's happening to Jesus? Verse 28. They led Jesus. Jesus is being led. That is, by somebody else. It's a birth that requires somebody acting upon him. So Jesus is in the passive role here. Jesus is being led by them. Verse 30. They answered Pilate, "If this man were not doing evil, we would not have delivered him to you." So Jesus is led, Jesus is delivered. We see this same verb being used in verse 35, 36, chapter 19, verse 11, verse 16. They lead Jesus, they deliver Jesus, they're instructed to take Jesus. Verse 31, "Take him yourselves." He's being judged. "Judge him by your own law." They're instructed to take Jesus. They're instructed to judge Jesus. Jesus is being judged. Pilate calls Jesus, verse 33. He calls to Jesus. Jesus has to come like a dog. "Come, Jesus. You, here." And Jesus has to obey. And we know, John's walked us from the very beginning, right? "In the beginning was the Word was with God. All things were made by him. Without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. The Word became flesh, tabernacled among us. We've beheld his glory, the glory is of the only begotten of the Father. No one's ever seen God, but the God who's at the Father's side has made him known. This is that one." And we come to this point in the story. And this primary character who's been doing signs and showing who he is, who stands up in the temple and says, "I'm the light of the world. If anyone's thirsty, let him come to me and drink." And at this moment, he's passive. Everything's happening to him. He's not doing anything. Everybody else is doing it to him. Pilate calls Jesus. Pilate offers to release Jesus in verse 39. Pilate brings out Jesus to be mocked, to be scorned, to be evaluated in 19 verse 4, 19 verse 13. Pilate presents Jesus, 19 verse 5, as the man, a little bit later as their king. And then they intend to crucify Jesus. But all the action that Jesus is a part of in this part of the story is happening to Jesus. So as we think authority, we see Jews and Pilate playing the power roles in this story, acting on Jesus. There's a paradoxical concern as we watch this transition from religion to politics. Verse 28, they go from the house of Caiaphas to the governor's headquarters. It was early morning, but they themselves, that is the Jews or the high priests that are bringing Jesus, they themselves did not enter the governor's headquarters so that they would not be defiled, so that they would not be made dirty, so that they would not be unrighteous, so that their religion would not be marred, so that their morals would not be bad. And even as they're doing this, they're doing it so that they can eat the Passover, right? What does the Passover point to? Points back to the Exodus, right? When they're ushered out of Egypt, where they're saved, where they're delivered. But wait a minute, what does the Passover point to? Points to the Exodus, which all along had been pointing to Jesus. That one who brings us out of darkness into the light. The one who gives us life. That Passover lamb who dies in our place. That blood that's put over us so that when we're under his blood, that judgment passes over us and we are rendered life rather than death in the judgment of God. They're concerned about the Passover. Well, the Passover is happening. This is the Passover. This is what this, way back here, some 1,500 years before Jesus is even born, was pointing to. This Passover, this Paschal Lamb, this perfect Lamb that had to be without blemish and without spot, that had to be 1 year old in the prime of its life. It had to be slaughtered, and its blood had to be painted on the wooden doorposts of the house. And everybody had to go in and stay in under the blood. And for 1,500 years, they celebrated this looking back. And this night, this morning of all mornings, is the day when they're concerned about the Passover. But the Passover is happening. They're concerned about being clean while they're in the middle of committing murder. Verse 31, Pilate says, you take him. You judge him by your own law. You judge him by your own books, your own histories, your own customs, your own ways of doing life. And the Jews said, nuh-uh. It's not lawful for us to put him to death. That's the sentence that we must have. We need this man dead. They could have done that. They'd done it before. You get a bunch of Jews riled up, and you get a mob, you bring them out on the street, and the Jewish way of dealing with the death penalty is take up a stone, and there's plenty of stones in Israel. You take up a stone, and you get a few hundred people, you get a couple thousand people, they're ready to stone. In fact, they were going to do it to Jesus a couple times during his ministry. They were going to bring him up on top of a cliff, throw him over, then throw rocks on top of him. They could do that. And Rome would have to write it off as a rowdy mob. You can't control a mob. But that wasn't sufficient. In fact, as we watch all of this happening, it's not primarily a matter of control for the Jews. It's a matter of sovereignty on behalf of God. Look at verse 32. This was to fulfill the word that Jesus had spoken, to show by what kind of death he was going to die. It wasn't a question, is Jesus going to die? That's the whole point. Jesus came to die. But as these Jews are manipulating and trying to get Jesus dead, Jesus wants nothing other than that's why Jesus came. This is the hour. But as they're seeking his death, they have to do it a certain way. They want to prove to those who are following Jesus, those who are excited about Jesus, those who just 7 days before were celebrating Jesus as he came into Jerusalem. Hosanna! Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord! This is the King of Israel! Yay! Jesus! They needed to commit all those people that this is a man who's cursed by God. How could they take this messianic hope and squelch it? They could take him and they could put him on a tree because the law had said, cursed is every man who hangs on a tree. And if you have a cursed Messiah, you have no Messiah at all, right? Because he's cursed by God. Religion for the Jews at the end of the day, being right with God, is an absolute must for the Messiah. And if he's hanging on a tree, bearing God's curse, he cannot be right with God. Ipso facto. It's fundamental. There's no other way about it, logically. Praise God. His economy doesn't operate on man's wisdom. Because it says that Jesus Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law by becoming a curse for us. For it is written, cursed is everyone who hangs on a tree. God's sovereignty was at work. So Pilate poses the question, what accusation do you bring? They retort, if this man wasn't an evildoer, we wouldn't have delivered him to you. Evildoer. The word there is kakos. He's one who performs kakos. We get the word cacophony from it. It's not just bad. It's ugly bad. It's like painful bad. It's like what my girls were trying to do last night when they were trying to sing, and one was bending the pitch up and one was bending the pitch down. It was like, ah, we could be done now, okay? This isn't beautiful. He's a bad doer. He's an ugly doer. As they're ready to murder him. Do you see? You see the paradox that's going on right here? The black hearts. He's dirty. We're not. The pilot throws it back at them. You take him. You judge him. He doesn't have much time for them. It's 6 o'clock in the morning, and he just doesn't have a lot of time for him. Pilate was one of those guys who politically he hated the Jews. He did everything that he could to kind of rub it in their face how much he hated them. They were a bothersome people. He was in this position for about 15 years, but they were always a threat to his political prestige and power. He made some stupid mistakes. He riled them up in some pretty dumb ways. He took their treasury and robbed their treasury in order to build an aqueduct into Jerusalem. He thought, well, hey, I'm benefiting them. We'll use their money. Well, they took religious money for political ends. That doesn't work when your whole economy is based on religion, right? There were several different times where he took shields and hung them up there in Jerusalem. Shields that had the face of the emperor on it. Well, thou shalt not carve any graven image. Again, he wasn't real bright in what he was doing. But these people were always a thorn in his flesh. They were a burr under his saddle. So he didn't have much time for them. And neither did they have for him. So he's going to propose a solution. He's going to say, well, listen, after he examines Jesus, we're going to jump down to verse 39. He says, listen, I find no guilt in him. You have a custom. I should release one man for you at the Passover. You want me to release this king of the Jews? And he gets an unexpected response. He's going to bring Jesus back out. He examines him for a little bit, brings him back out. And he knows the chief priests are against Jesus. He knows that Caiaphas, the high priest, is against Jesus. He doesn't like Caiaphas. He doesn't care about the chief priests. But he's concerned about the people. The mob, the populace. He's got to control them. He's got to kind of keep them in. He's got to win their graces because at the end of the day, if he loses the people, he loses his position. He loses his power. So he brings them out and says, listen, how about I release to you the king of the Jews? Now he says this king of the Jews, he kind of snubs it in the face of Caiaphas, the high priest. This is your king. This ugly weakling here is your king. But the Jews who he's trying to pacify, I mean, just 6 days ago, 7 days ago, they were championing him as he walks into Jerusalem. How about I release this guy? And boom, that quick. What if I release Jesus? Not this man, but Barabbas. And then it gives those closing words at the end of this chapter. Now, Barabbas was a robber. That word could mean insurrectionist, but it has the idea of thievery in particular. And so when it talks about this man who's a thief or a robber, it has the idea of one who takes from others in order to benefit self. We're given a little bit bigger picture as you put together this picture of Barabbas and the other Gospels. In Matthew 27, he's called a notorious prisoner. Everybody knew about Barabbas. Why did they know about Barabbas? Mark 15. Because he was among the rebels who sat in prison because they had committed murder in the resurrection. Not the resurrection, the insurrection. In the insurrection. So here you've got a guy who's opposing Rome. He's functioning for the Jews. He's opposing Rome. But he's doing it in a political way. He's doing it in arm of the flesh kind of way. He's doing it in the power broker kind of way. He's doing it in the way that Peter tried to do it there in the Garden of Gethsemane, taking the sword, hacking at the head of the high priest's servant, right? we're going to take care of this thing, and we'll do it our way. Sounds like Laverne and Shirley. We're going to do this our way. Boom. We're going to take care of this. And so he's a hero for the people. This is what they want. They want somebody to throw off the shackles of Rome. They want somebody who's willing to commit murder, who's willing to take out those pigs that are over us, wipe them off the face of the earth, free Jerusalem so that we can worship our God. Barabbas is a hero because Barabbas operates by authority. He takes authority for himself. He takes power for himself. It's going to cost somebody something. But at the end of the day, if you're on the right side, it doesn't matter, right? We will rock you. That's our goal. That's our job. That's our modus operandi. We will rock you. We will rock your world. That's Barabbas. That's not Jesus. Jesus says, I will die for you. I will die in your place. You are the guilty. You are the condemned. You are the damned. You are the filthy. You are the sinful. You are the cursed. And I will die in your place. Does that make any sense? Not in our economy. Not in our economy whatsoever. We move from the accusation and the ethics. Let's move to the politics. We have to move through this much more quickly. As Pilate brings Jesus in to examine him, it's going to be just Pilate and Jesus. They're going to have this private conference. Verse 33, so Pilate enters his headquarters. He calls Jesus and says to him, listen, are you the king of the Jews? You? He's looking at Jesus. Pilate is a politician. Pilate is a soldier. Pilate has seen lots of insurrectionists. And he's looking at Jesus and he says, you? And it's emphatic in its position in the sentence. I don't picture you being this valiant hero of the populace. And we're not told the judgment that takes place between the high priest and Jesus, but we're told in other Gospels that they found him guilty because he had made himself the Son of God. He was going to be that Son of Man who conquers. And Jesus says, listen, next time you see me, the Son of Man will return in power with his angels. And they tear out their beards, they tear off their clothes. They're like, what in the world? You have just committed blasphemy by claiming to be the Son of God, to claim to be the King, the one that God himself, sitting on the throne, gives power, Daniel chapter 7. You claim to be that man. Word had already gotten to Pilate. He says, Jesus, really? You? I mean, when he asks this question, go back to Daniel chapter 7, because this is the context of what this word, King of the Jews, means. Daniel chapter 7, verse 9. As I looked, thrones were placed, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. He was clothed with white clothing, was white as snow. His hair of his head was like pure wool. His throne was fiery flames. His wheels were burning fire. A stream of fire issued and came out from before him, and thousands served him. 10,000s times 10,000 stood before him. Verse 13, and I saw in the night visions, behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like a Son of Man. And he approached, he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before the Ancient of Days. And to him was given dominion to be king. To him was given glory. To him was given a kingdom so that all peoples, nations, languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away. His kingdom one that shall never be destroyed. Pilate says, Jesus, really? You? I just can't picture it. And Jesus answers, are you saying this of your own accord, or did somebody say this to you about me? And Pilate, in his frustrated way, says, listen, I'm not a Jew. I don't believe your fairy tales from the book of Daniel. I believe one thing. I believe in power. I believe in the sword. I believe that I'm in charge and these dogs are not. That's what I believe. I'm not a Jew. I'm not following your fancy fairy tales. Listen, your nation, your chief priests, they've all delivered you to me. Just tell me, what have you done? Are you a king? Are you planning an insurrection? How many disciples you got? Let's get this out on the table. Let's deal with this. And Jesus answers him. Verse 36. My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have been fighting that I might not be delivered to the Jews. But my kingdom is not from the world. Pilate says to him, so you are a king. Jesus said, you say that I'm a king. For this purpose I was born. For this purpose I've come into this world. I came to bear witness to the truth. And everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice. See, there's two new realms that Jesus introduces into this whole faction. We've got the realm of religion and the realm of politics. Jesus says there's two realms that you're not even thinking of. I'm telling you, there's the realm of this world and there's the realm of the truth. And it's not that this world isn't true, but those who are of the truth are of another world, because this world operates by untruth. It operates by manipulation. It operates by taking. This other world operates in a totally different way. It operates by truth. It operates by giving. It operates by receiving. It operates by waiting, not taking. It operates by sacrificing. There's two different worlds, Pilate, and you're not even close to coming to understanding what this even means. And so Pilate asks the question there, that third question. So what is truth? What is truth? You talk about truth, Jesus. Tell me what truth is. He doesn't wait. He doesn't want to know. He's got things to do. He's got people mad. He's got to get to the next thing on the agenda. And so, in the middle there of verse 38, after he said this, he went back to the Jews and told them, listen, I don't find any guilt in this guy. He asks the most important question that can be asked. What is truth? Remember what Jesus, as he's praying to the Father? He said, Father, this is life. That they would know you, the only true God, and Jesus Christ, whom you've sent. As he tells his disciples, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. And Pilate, staring Jesus in the face, staring God in the face, asks with a kind of simplicity and kind of a carelessness, what is truth? And he's looking at Jesus, but he doesn't have time to drill down on that answer because the next thing has to happen. The calendar's moving. The clock is ticking. The sun is moving across the sky. The people are getting hungry. The people are getting rowdy. I don't have time to drill down on this existential question of truth. And so he leaves confused rather than having this question clarified. And so as he walks out, the people cry out, not this man, but Barabbas. And Barabbas is the robber. And so we see things moving forward as Pilate takes him again. And he's questioning, he's wondering. He finds no guilt in the man. Three times he says, verse 38, chapter 19, verse 4, chapter 19, verse 6, I find no guilt in him. I find no guilt in him. I find no guilt in him. Ethically, this man is clean. You guys got nothing on him. I'm going to tell you what we're going to do. I'm going to beat him up a little bit. I'm going to rough him up a little bit. I'm going to flog him. And so verse chapter 19, verse 1, he takes him out. He flogs him. And this is probably the lesser of two floggings. Jesus was probably flogged two times that morning. This would have been the lesser. Probably with reeds, probably not with the cat of nine tails at this point. Maybe with a whip, but not with the balls of bone or metal embedded in them. So Jesus would have been whipped, beaten, scourged, bloodied up a little bit, black and blued. And then he brings him out. In fact, as he turns him over to the soldiers, they do it just a little bit more than the black and blue. They take thorns, and they twist together these thorns. These are from an olive tree. They could have spikes up to 12 inches long, 4 to 12 inches long on these huge spikes. They take it and they put it on Jesus' head. Okay, this isn't even as harsh as an older brother putting it on his younger brother's head. Listen, be careful with your little brother. That's a thorn. These are soldiers who have nothing better to do than to watch somebody scream in pain. So they take this thorn crown, they put it on his head, and then they take a reed like a hammer and they bop it on there. Then they take a robe. King, huh? Hey! They throw this robe on him in verse 3. They come up to him and say, "Hail, King of the Jews!" Yeah, this is... You've got a bunch of rowdy soldiers who hate the people that they're serving, and now they find one who's a rabble-rouser, and they have permission to abuse him. So what are they going to do? Abuse him. We're told in other passages that they spit on him. They plucked his beard. Here they slap him in the face. And so after they abuse him and have their fun with Jesus for a little while, Pilate brings him out and says, "Behold the man. Behold the man. This is the guy that you want dead, right? Look at him. He's bloodied. He's beaten. He calls himself a Messiah. So much for your messiahs, Jews. This is the best you got to offer? Some king." And he taunts and mocks Jesus himself. Some king. But as he says, "Behold the man," what we understand from Scripture is that when Adam stood in the garden and fell, he fell for all mankind. When Jesus stands here at Gabbatha, here at the judgment seat, he refuses to fall. And he stands in the place of every man. When Adam failed, it affected every man. When Jesus succeeds, it affects all of humanity. Behold the man. This is the second Adam. This is the second head of the entire race. This isn't just King of the Jews stuff. This is head of humanity stuff. And Pilate doesn't even realize what he's saying. This is the man. This is the man who's standing in for every failure, every sinner, every deceiver, every liar, every murderer, every adulterer. This is the man. He's become the denier, Peter. He's become the persecutor, Paul. He's become the adulterer, David. He's standing in for every man. That's the man. So they abuse Jesus and they chant out, "No, crucify him." Verse 7 of chapter 9. Pilate had said for the third time, "I find no guilt in him." And the Jews answered him, "But we have a law. We have a law, and according to that law, this man must die." And they're going to explain, "Because he has made himself the Son of God." He's made himself. He's taken an authority that he has no right to claim. He's taken authority to call himself the Son of God. Now, verse 8, when Pilate heard this statement, he was afraid. In fact, it intimates that he was probably already afraid, because now he's even more afraid. Wait a minute. I don't just have angry crowd. I don't just have this bothersome chief priest to work with. I've got a man who says he's a god. What if that's true? And so he brings him back inside. And we see there in verse 9, Pilate brings him back into the headquarters and he says, "Jesus, listen, where are you from? This doesn't make sense. You talk about being from another world, not of this world. Where are you from?" And Jesus doesn't answer him. And Pilate's going to pull the authority card. He says, "Listen, you answer me. I've got the authority. I have the right. I have the power. I can either let you go or kill you." Jesus takes one little pin and pops the entire balloon and he says, "Listen, you would have no authority over me unless it was given to you from above. No authority. Therefore, he who's delivered me over to you has the greater sin." You want to talk about sin? Taking the Son of God and condemning him to death, that's a sin. But those who rejected their own Messiah, that's a greater sin. They rejected truth when they knew the truth and it stood and looked him in the face. That's a greater sin. Verse 12. From then on, Pilate sought to release him. He brings them out to the Jews and he says, listen, verse 14, listen, behold your king. Listen, I've examined this guy. There's nothing wrong with him. He's magnificent. I'm terrified. His wife had sent him a telegram there in the middle of the day. Said, listen, have nothing to do with this innocent man. I've suffered so many things in a dream because of him. This guy is good. He brings him out and says, listen, I want him to go free. This is your king. He said, crucify him. Away with him. Away with him, verse 15. Crucify him. Pilate's ready to give the judgment. He's there. He's positioned himself on the judgment seat. He's operating as the voice of Rome. He has the authority to pronounce up or down, life or death. But he asks one question. He says, shall I crucify your king? Who am I? Who am I to crucify your king? Who am I to crucify the king of the Jews? Who am I to crucify the Son of Man who stands before the Ancient of Days? Who am I? You want me to do this? You want me to kill your king? So crucify him. We have no king but Caesar. That was a lie. He knew it. But they said, listen, everyone who makes himself a king opposes Caesar. And Pilate, if you release this man, verse 12, you're not Caesar's friend. You're not Caesar's friend. Well, Pilate had gotten in a lot of trouble with the Jews, and what we don't know except from history, it's not recorded in the Bible, but Pilate's intercessor, Pilate's benefactor, and his political buffer back in Rome was Sejanus. Sejanus got Pilate the position there in Palestine. And as Pilate bumbled so many things so many times, Sejanus was the one who kind of calmed the waters back in Rome, helped him keep his position. Well, Sejanus was gaining popularity in Rome, so much so that Tiberius said, why don't you come to the Senate? That afternoon, Sejanus comes into the Senate. He's killed. He's knocked off. He was a political threat. That happened just before this crucifixion, a matter of months. And now the Jews pull out their wild card. They have authority over the one who's in charge. Say, Pilate, you give us what you want, what we want, or you know what's going to happen? Someone in Rome is going to find out. And you no longer have your babysitter. You no longer have a benefactor. Pilate, it would behoove you if you give us what we want. So what's he do? So he delivered him over to them to be crucified. So who wins this authority struggle? Pilate doesn't. He wants to free Jesus before it's all said and done. Jesus obviously doesn't because he's on his way to death. He's going to go get the worst flogging ever, which rips and shreds organs as well as the flesh on the outside. Looks like the Jews win, right? Well, let's pull this apart just a little bit. Milne writes, the charges against Jesus are twofold, that of blasphemy, which is brought by the Jewish authorities, and treason, which is what he was on trial before Rome. So Jesus is going to die as a blasphemer and a traitor. These are precisely the two charges that we face at the judgment seat of God. We're blasphemers. We're traitors. Jesus dies as both. A blasphemer to the Jews, a traitor to the crown, Caesar. Jesus obviously doesn't win. So what's this story got to do with authority? Well, the chief priests who have religious authority abdicate their responsibility. They mar their souls by submitting to the flesh and they start to play politics. These are the ones, again, chief priests. They're the ones who are supposed to stand between sinful people and holy God. And what do? They use their authority to pad their pockets, to put themselves in positions, to buy palaces, to operate with power. How about Pilate? Pilate has political authority. Well, he abdicates responsibility as he submits to the will of these unethical Jews. Well, Jesus has metaphysical authority. He has that moral authority, philosophical. He knows what truth is. He is truth. Jesus doesn't abdicate any of his responsibility. In fact, Jesus fulfills his responsibility. But he doesn't do it by exercising his authority in a power-hungry kind of way. He fulfills his responsibility by submitting to the will of the Father. Listen, all of them surrender their authority. The chief priests, the Jews, they lose control. They lose their religious authority because they give it up to the flesh. Pilate loses his religious authority because he's overrun by the machinations of his own political machine. Jesus loses authority in the eyes of all people as the Messiah of these people, but only one of these authorities resigns his authority with sovereignty. That's Jesus. Remember what Jesus had said way back in John chapter 10? John chapter 10, verse 18. Jesus said, "No one takes my life from me. I lay it down of my own accord. I have authority to lay it down. I have authority to take it up again. I have this charge, this authority from my Father." As Jesus goes to the cross, when it looks like the other authorities win and he loses everything, we know that Jesus is accomplishing exactly what he said he would do in John chapter 10, verse 11. "I'm the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep." Jesus didn't lose anything. Jesus gained everything. My friend, there's no power in the universe that can compete with the beauty of submission. We see it in the life of Jesus. He has the authority. How does he exercise that authority? By submitting to the perfect will of the Father. There's no wonder why Peter says, "Listen, you want to see true beauty? Look at a wife who submits. Look at a wife who's the weaker vessel and puts herself under the authority of a God-imposed authority in her life. That's true beauty, my friend. It looks like Jesus. It looks like power. It looks like somebody who's willing to take God's will and trust Him to bring the good that only He can bring." Wow. My friend, where do you stand today? Are you trying to pull strings? Are you trying to manipulate? Are you trying to get? Are you trying to take? Are you trying to posture yourself so that you can get ahead? Are you complaining and frustrating with what life brings your way? Life, providence, God. Because God is sending you the exact things into your life to reveal His power and to make your life count for eternity. Let's pray.